Last night saw a momentous occasion in the New York City debut of Lucha Vavoom at Webster Hall. Tomorrow night we'll see another momentous occasion in the autumnal equinox here in the Northern Hemisphere. But tonight you'll have to settle for the September 21st, 2009 edition of the Loser Leaves Town podcast here on CagesideSeats.com. This is David Bixenspan, and what you're about to hear are two interviews that I did last night before the show. First up will be TJ Perkins, a.k.a. Puma and Cobra 2, who wrestles for Lucha Vavoom as El Bombero. And then you'll be hearing from Cassandro, the number one exotico in wrestling today, and thought they're pretty good interviews, and I hope you all enjoy them. Hello, everybody. This is David Bixenspan here on the Loser Leaves Town podcast as part of CagesideSeats.com on SB Nation. And I am here live on tape at Webster Hall on the Lower East Side of Manhattan in New York City at the New York debut of Lucha Vavoom. And right now, for my first guest, I am joined by actually a number of guests. TJ Perkins, the Pinoy Boy.
Hello.
That's just a nickname. I'm also joined by Cobra 2.
Hello.
Cobra 2. What was I forgetting? Puma. Puma of Los Havana Brothers.
How you doing?
And they're all here to watch their friend El Bombero tonight as he participates in the festivities. So I guess I wanted to ask Cobra 2 first a question. Didn't Cobra 1 actually wrestle as Cobra 2 once?
You know, I would not put it past George Takano to have been both 1 and 2. he's done quite a bit of business. In fact, I saw him as recently as 2003 or 4, still working. So I wouldn't doubt that.
Okay, so I guess I wanted to ask TJ Perkins, the Pinoy Boy. Well, I guess you have not been around on as many, I guess as visible lately, aside from being around maybe at Lucha Vavoom, and I just wanted to know why.
I guess, you know, different radars would probably be the best way to put it. I guess it's kind of like a career thing, you know, each guys change their goals, and they get to certain places, and they choose different paths, and you know, at the time and place that I'm at, I felt like I was ready to take on different things. I kind of took my career in a different direction. So it's kind of going a little bit away from the core wrestling crowd that's used to seeing me on more I guess you could say, trendy shows. And I'm trying to throw my hat in a few other rings and see what I can get going. That's kind of it, you know, aiming for different companies and things like that.
Now, so far here in Lucha Vavoom, how have you seen the crowd make up? Like, is it how much wrestling fans, how much non-wrestling fans, how much casual, you know, I watch Raw sometimes, how much people who are familiar with either you or the Mexican talent?
I'd say if you were to judge Lucha Vavoom as a wrestling company based on its fans, wrestling fans, how many wrestling fans are here, on a scale of 1 to 10, it would be a negative 1,000 for a wrestling company. It's very much the casual fan. Definitely fans that enjoy pro wrestling, but it's a lot more like a production that you would get from a TV company such as WWE or you know, even overseas, a TV style company like a Hustle or New Japan. The atmosphere is really big, and the action is more superimposed than it would be, you know, on the hardcore indie scene where you see a lot of, you know, innovative and artistic things. So, it's a louder and more colorful version, of what a lot of us do every day and what a lot of your listeners, and readers probably would see. So.
Alrighty. So, is this your first time working in New York?
First time in New York? No, actually. I've been in New York, a few times. I believe I may have worked here for Ring of Honor in Manhattan. I'm not sure of that. And I worked
in Long Island previously, and guest coached a seminar before, and passed through here once before that. Like I would say around, more so around like 2002 or 2003. But I've only ever been here a handful of times, mm-hmm. So it's actually a nice experience getting to come back to the big city.
So what promotion did you use seminar for? NYWC or one of those, or?
Gosh, I feel real bad because it slips my mind at the moment. I need to rope Azriel over here. He can give me the lowdown on where I was at the time. I do feel real bad because I can't remember the name of it.
Well, it's always interesting to me that, I guess it's because of the commission, that you don't have that much indie wrestling here, either in the city or in the suburbs. I guess, you know, given the population that, now, I mean, did you still need to get a license and stuff, or do they need to get promoter's licenses?
You know, it's funny that you mention that, because I didn't know that there's a commission at all in New York. So whatever I did, it must have been highly illegal.
They may have changed it. They may have made it that the promoters still need licenses, but the wrestlers don't.
Could be, because I've also heard that Florida is commissioned, and I have yet, after being there for about a year, I have yet to be confronted about it, so...
Yeah, I mean, the only trace I really notice anymore is that, you know, I think most promotions will still use Max because that was a commission rule. Remember when USA Pro was still up here, they used these ridiculous, like, you know, like the little, like, foam mats that you'll see at a nursery school?
Yes.
They had those. They weren't like, you know, gym mats.
We're talking like puzzle pieces?
Yes, those, exactly.
Oh, those are great.
And that's probably part of the reason why they are no longer in New York.
I quite like the puzzle pieces, actually.
Someone, I believe that was Little Cholo, just brought in someone I did not recognize without a mask, just brought in a Dragon Gate bag. It is Little Cholo.
Yeah,
okay.
We like to call him not-so-Little Cholo these days, actually. So
that bag is awesome, that Dragon Gate bag.
Oh, yeah, they're very pretty and waterproof, actually, too, if you look at them.
Is that, you know, if that's like a Ribera jacket type thing, or you got to be a wrestler, or is that a thing?
Oh, God, I hope so, because I don't want everybody walking around with those bad boys.
I heard they stopped making the jackets, by the way.
You know, I don't know. I haven't been to Japan since 2006 or 2007, and I had gotten a couple jackets prior. I mean, everybody does, I guess, so it's kind of join the club. But I don't know if they stopped making them. I do know that if you already have a jacket, they offer you a secondary prize of Zubaz pants. And I'm not kidding. I got a pair of cloudy Zubaz pants after my fifth or sixth tour there.
Yeah. My dad was so happy when the brand name Zubaz came out again like a year ago.
I love Zubaz.
Yeah. So you, where were you initially trained? Because I know you went through the LA Dojo when that was running for New Japan, and I'm not sure exactly who trained you initially, how'd you break in, etc.
Well, I became a pro wrestler because I was bit by a radioactive pro wrestler. Most people don't know that.
Would that be Brad Armstrong?
Maybe. The New Japan years are actually quite a few years down the line from when I first started. Mm-hmm. I guess because of my age, people guess that that's kind of a starting point for me. But I started when I was 14, and I there's a lot of Lucha Libre gyms in Los Angeles, obviously because of the culture and everything, so there's not as much regulations and things as far as people unwilling to take on underage trainees. And most of the schools that I wanted to apply for back in 1998 were, you know, they were all out of town. I believe Dean Malenko had a school in Tampa, which is much too far for me because I was just 13 years old. And All Pro Wrestling had a school in San Francisco, and they would only take 18 and over, and they were also far from Los Angeles. Later on, Shawn Michaels started advertising his school in 99, and I was really interested in going there, but same idea. I was just too young, so... When I was 14, I found a local gym that would take me on. After a few months, I started working on cards. And from about the age of 14 and 15, I was doing local cards in San Bernardino and Los Angeles. UPW had, I believe they had the developmental around that time in 99, 2000. And I was working there, which is a great experience for a teenager to be around guys like William Regal and Triple H, different people passing through for, you know, business purposes, and also going over the border to Tijuana and Mexicali. So a lot of my international experience took place when I was only 14.
Is it weird? I guess now, maybe, I don't know if you do or you don't see as many guys getting into the young, but do people, when they first see you, I guess they don't know you, do they not realize here's a guy who's over a 10-year veteran now?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, like, everywhere I go, guys always assume that I am the trainee of my friends or whoever I'm with at the time. When I showed up in Ring of Honor in 2003, they assumed I was Bryan Danielson's student, and we were just friends and training partners. We both went on our first New Japan tours together. In fact, I believe my match went on before his, so technically I beat him there. but stuff like that, you know. So I think guys equate my age to my experience, which I guess is kind of flattering because it shows, you know, how much I got left in the tank, hopefully, and a lot of experience that I have at a young age. So, you know.
Well, now, as far as having a lot left in the tank, do you think that training initially in the lucha style and doing a lot of that, do you think that down the line you're going to be a lot more durable because of that?
I hope so, man. I do find, because I keep a really steady training regimen. I still train wherever a local gym is, wherever I happen to be living. You know, I've lived in Toronto, I've lived in Los Angeles, I'm living in Florida now, spent a year in Mexico, lived in the dojos in Tokyo and Japan. Everywhere I've gone, I've always kept a really steady training regimen, but one thing I've noticed is that the generations that have passed, guys just are not brought up the way that I was brought up. And that's not to say that I'm like an old school guy. It's not like I was around back in 78 kicking it with Flair and you know, Georgia. But, you know, back in the late 90s, that's the generation I broke in. And not that it was old school, but it was a lot harder on me. I worked a lot harder and continued to work really hard because that's the way I was brought up. And I feel like if anything's going to be a testament to my longevity, it'll be that, because I think it instilled a great work ethic that I think is kind of disappearing at the moment.
Okay. Now, so I guess you're saying you're not old school, but you're older school.
I hope I am middle school at least. I don't know. I do think that generations are changing. It makes me a little sad, but hopeful that maybe the business will kind of reset itself. Because I broke in at a time when it was really hard, and veterans were really hard on you, you know. And guys think they have it hard now, but it was just a lot different, you know. I mean, I was coming up with guys that I legitimately feared, you know. Like, that just doesn't happen anymore, you know. So, I don't know.
So, who were, like, I guess the main guys in the lucha gyms in California that I guess were your trainers or mentors?
Well, you know, I don't know that I've ever really had any single guy that I could say they were the coach, my coach. If I could name one, I'd probably say Kevin Quinn. He's out of Chicago. He was living in Los Angeles around 2000, and I was already trained and working, but I came across him, and he was one of the guys that took me on in his gym, I was already working, but he really made me into a much better wrestler, and things that he said will stick with me forever, you know. But I would say the generation coming up that was just ahead of me at the time were, you know, Christopher Daniels had just gotten hot over in Michinoku Pro, you know. A lot of guys that aren't really around anymore, to be honest, because I was coming in literally at the same time as all the guys who are now looked at as all the veterans, you know, the CM Punks, the Samoa Joes, you know, guys like that. That's my generation, which kind of shocks people because of how young I am. They don't know how long back it goes, but yeah, I don't know that there's a lot of people that guys would remember, to be honest, that are even still around other than Christopher Daniels.
Now, did you go through like WPW and Martin Marin or at all?
I had worked for them when I was younger, but that's not a place that I ever really laid roots for training or anything. I mean, there's a lot of very nameless
gyms in Southern California for Lucha Libre that I passed through. Probably the one, though, that, I mean, it's the one that I started at is School of Hard Knocks in San Bernardino.
Bill Anderson and Jesse Hernandez.
Yeah. The best parts of their career took place in Mexico, you know, and they had a really strong Lucha Libre culture in their gym, and I guess it passed through to the business sense because they definitely took me on without me being an adult, so...
Wait a second, I'm thinking with your age. Were you the kid in the Learning Channel documentary?
I was in a lot of documentaries, and I don't know if I was.
I remember there was a Learning Channel documentary with a 14-year-old kid at School of Hard Knocks, and I remember, like, this kid was like, I just love to go to the school and kick ass.
Oh, no, that was not me, but I do remember that documentary.
Okay. So, now, yeah, but with the, there really are a lot of lucha gyms. I remember Kurt Brown, I remember, you know, who's involved with Incredibly Strange Wrestling, I'm friendly with, who I had on the last couple shows. You know, he did a lot of lucha-style stuff. He went through, I think, in the 80s, it was Chacal Rivera's gym. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he would always know just rave. He had trained a couple years earlier, and once he had been a lucha fan, but once he started training in lucha, he was like, oh my god, you know, not only is this fun, but my knees are better. Now, I guess, so, I guess, when would you say, I guess I started to hear about you, it would have been before the LA Dojo stuff, but not long before then. So I guess, how did you and other California guys, how did you really start to get involved with the New Japan LA Dojo?
Well, as best I can tell, the complete timeline happened as such that 01 and UPW had a working agreement, and Hashimoto and guys were coming into work for UPW when around the time that they were doing developmental stuff. The middleman between the two companies was Simon Inoki. Simon and Hiroko Inoki are part of the Inoki family. Hiroko Inoki is Antonio Inoki's daughter. Being that they were the ambassadors for 01, when,
you know what, Ollie, we'll pause. Okay, so we were talking about something with Simon, Simon Kelly Inoki.
Yes. He was the middleman between 01 and UPW. When New Japan decided they want to open a United States branch, I believe for talent relation purposes, to open a new gym for development, things of that nature, Simon was the guy to go to.
So, I apologize for interrupting for a second. So this, I guess this is at the point where 01 was still sort of part of New Japan.
Yeah, I mean, like, they had, I mean, you had Hashimoto and Otani go over and they start 01. I don't personally know how the business was between the two. I wouldn't be surprised if they were completely fine with each other, and I wouldn't be surprised if they hated each other, such as Dragon Gate and Toriumon. But I do know it was that type of situation with Takaiwa and the guys going over and starting their own place. And the way it came about was Simon started this gym and he had nobody in there, and he didn't know the area very well. Joe was the big UPW guy going over for 01. Joe, through Simon, helped get guys into the gym because Simon needed guys. And myself, the Havana Pitbulls, really were the only three guys there for at least a couple of years, I would say. After a few months, American Dragon moved down. New Japan was taking a look at him, and they really wanted to bring him over. So the four of us pretty much made up the gym for a couple of years, and that was it. That was way before we did shows or anything. It was just a training facility.
Now, I mean, I guess, what were the politics, though, that led to Joe sort of being ignored and not really being allowed on the shows later on? Because I remember, aside from there was, like, this one picture later on, you would read about people talking about how he was sort of, like, the secret member of the LA Dojo.
Well, the reason behind that is the business change has changed so much since, like, 2000, 2001. At that time, it was literally unheard of for a guy to switch companies in Japan. It was a huge deal, which is why 01 and companies that broke off were a huge, huge deal. Like, 01 in and of itself was never better than an independent promotion, but it got such a huge following because of the politics of switching companies. Joe, being the gaijin for 01, but helping out New Japan, kind of, I believe, would have caused problems for Joe. And later on, after he had kind of finished up with Zero One, he requested to come in for New Japan, since he had already kind of been helping behind the scenes, obviously because of the way the business was at the time. He couldn't just jump back and forth between the two companies, so he was always working for Zero One and just helping New Japan, since we were friends. But after his tenure with Zero One was kind of over, the business still was a little old school for that, and they didn't want him because he was painted with such strong Zero One colors. Now you got guys that they're stars everywhere they go. You got the Machine Guns and Sanjay Dutt and different guys that'll just go and work anywhere, which is great. But before them, when we were going over, the business was different. So that's why Joe was always the secret member of our group.
Yeah, I remember even reading in old newsletters. I remember reading something recently. It was like, Nightmare Danny Davis is going to go for Wing, but he was supposed to go to All Japan. So he probably won't be able to go to All Japan because now he's going to be seen as an indie guy and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I mean, they were really strict about stuff like that. I mean, there still are a lot of things that are like that. But, I mean, they've broken down a lot of the barriers since in the years that I've gone over. I was able to kind of see a change right before my eyes, you know, from when I first went over and 2002 all the way up to 07. But yeah, so I mean that was kind of the hard luck for Joe, is that he really deserved to go, and he did so much for the company, but the sad thing was he was just in a tough spot, and the business was not yet evolved to what it is now.
Now, you ended up in CMLL through the LA Dojo, right?
Yes, that is correct.
Now, I'm trying to remember, were you in the initial Mexican version of the Havana Brothers, or were you in the second version?
I was version number one.
Okay, it was you, Rocky, and Ricky, and then it was you, Rocky, and Bobby Clance, right?
Well, actually, it was myself, Rocky, and Bobby were the first group to go over.
Okay.
It was supposed to be myself and both of the Havana Pitbulls. A couple weeks prior to leaving, our coach at the dojo at the time, Justin McCulley, thought it would be good for us to do some independent MMA fights as part of our MMA training. At the time, I mean, you know, which we can, I guess, touch more on later, MMA hadn't really hit the ceiling yet, so we were kind of the driving force behind introducing that to the independents. And it was just his idea of getting us more involved in mixed martial arts, and we did these fights. You know, Rocky won his. I fought a guy who had been fighting since I was in eighth grade, and I was destroyed. I fought him twice in a row, armbarred the first time, and I got choked out the second time. Ricky wasn't so lucky. He was in with a really strong kickboxer, and he was able to get the takedowns really well. But in the later rounds, he couldn't catch the slippery legs, and he broke his arm trying to block a high kick.
Ugh.
And just snapped the bone right in half, and he couldn't go to Mexico with us since we were leaving a couple weeks later. So Bobby Quance, who was never originally even scheduled to go,
and is also Caucasian.
Yeah, our San Francisco contingent. He joined us, and later on, after we spent the better part of a year there, Ricky was healed, and I had wanted to move on to other things, so when we all came home to take a break, I moved on, and that was when I debuted in Ring of Honor in 03, and I started doing other stuff, and Ricky took my place in Mexico, so.
Now, what was it, now I guess, had you been to New Japan yet, or were you, as far as working shows, or when did CMLL shows come first?
No, New Japan came first. We had done two tours of Japan, both times around Tokyo Dome celebration time, I guess, is what they would call it. And I guess probably after the first couple tours, they really wanted to see what we can do. I mean, they were starting to trust us in Japan, but they knew that we had lucha backgrounds, and especially with me, they likened me a lot more to like a Tiger Mask or Rey Mysterio, so they thought it'd be a good idea to send us to Mexico as an excursion, see if we can grow a little bit more and come back with more tools. Mm-hmm. So we had already been over
a few times over the course of a year, and then we were sent to Mexico. So.
Okay, so now I'm trying to remember. Did you get to work on any of the Dome shows, or were you on that like that pre-anniversary, pre-Dome show thing they did?
Yeah, they did a two-day Dome show where they had a festival show at the Dome the day before that had, I want to say, three matches and some other segments, and then the main Dome show was the next day. And I wrestled on that one on day one. And the first tour we went on, the Pitbulls and Dragon worked a six-man on the Dome, and I was just the second. I just walked to the ring all the time. I mean, I was pretty young. I was only, it's like 2 weeks after my 18th birthday, I think, so I don't know that they would maybe trust me with that role, unless my name was Nakajima. So,
by the way, just to sidetrack for a second, did the Sasakis actually adopt him?
You know, I have no idea, and Scott Norton used to tell me all the time that he felt sorry for the poor kid, because that's got to be a strange piece of business for him. But the kid is fantastic, and he's quite a bruiser. I mean, he's about as real as it gets. He's a legit, badass guy. I mean, he won an MMA fight in 50 seconds when he was 15 years old.
Same show that had, I think, Daniel Peters' first fight, didn't it?
You know, maybe, actually.
I think it did.
Yeah, so, I mean, the kid's really something, so.
Okay, so anyway, so were you mostly working, like, the spot shows and co-working hall, or did you also go to Budokan or Sumo Hall?
Well, I went and did all the regular shows they had on any of the tours.
So
I was never really limited, except for the first tour I didn't work the Dome.
Mm-hmm.
I would do Korakuen, but I would do everything, Osaka, whatever, you know, came up.
So, yeah. So I was going to ask, really, because I was going to figure out was Arena Mexico, I just think of the size of the room, was that the biggest crowd, though, you had a match in front of up to that point?
No, the Dome definitely was.
Okay, because I couldn't remember how many people were at the first Dome.
The Dome definitely was, it was pretty full, even for that first day.
It just looked small because it was the Dome.
It looked, I think the reason it looked small is because we didn't use the ramp. We used the side entrances, so coming from the ground, like All Japan style, and they cleared out a section of the floor for the pachinko tournament, so they had all the pachinko machines down there. Other than that, it was a pretty normal draw. You know, I'd say it was still 75% full.
Mm-hmm.
But the Arena Mexico crowd for the anniversary shows, probably the most lively, because I mean it's like their WrestleMania, you know. And
the Dome, so the Dome crowds are also known for being sedate compared to other shows.
Yeah, very much.
Because they draw more casual fans, and it's a bigger building, so it's harder to.
Yeah, unless you're Misawa, you're not going to get guys jumping on chairs or anything. So the anniversary show in Arena Mexico was pretty good. I mean, that was, I'd say, a little over 20,000, maybe 22 at the most, but really hot and lively. The acoustics in that building are fantastic, so.
Even though it doesn't come across on TV, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, it's really sad because it's like being at a really wild, like, you know, like a European soccer game or an American college football game. I mean, it's very loud and very religious-type followings.
Yeah, I remember on the, you'd always hear, oh, the crowd's so hot, but the, you know, Televisa doesn't know how to, you know, how to mic it. And I remember one time, like, I saw when they aired it on the Wrestling Channel, eventually they decided, since we're English language, we'll turn down the commentary. And finally, you could hear just how hot, you know, it wasn't even a big show. It wasn't even one of the major shows, like the anniversary or anything. And it was just, you know, crowd. So you, in Mexico, you were mainly, at least on, you know, the main CMLL shows, it was mainly Havana Brothers feuding with Volador Jr., Virus, and why am I forgetting all this stuff? Oh, Rick Mark, right?
Yes.
So,
big feud.
Now, I guess they were, would you say they were pretty much the perfect opponents for you in Mexico?
I would say for us, yes, just because they were really good at being able to adapt physically. I mean, despite our backgrounds, I mean, we're still American guys and we're still trying to learn their system, and every place has a different system, which is why, you know, places like WWE, for example, have developmental and Japan has dojos. It's all the same thing. They just want to have guys to get accustomed. Those guys had pretty good international experience working with guys coming in, and Ricky Marvin, of course, going overseas. So
we were able to learn from each other. Personally, I feel like Ricky Marvin's the guy that taught me to really go fast. I mean, I was always a good athlete, but I never really tapped into how hard I can push myself until I was working with Ricky. And likewise, Ricky was one of the first guys to really trust me, despite my age, because he knew that I was capable of really good things. So,
so now, have you ever been able to live down the first promo you guys cut on TMLL TV?
I don't know what you're talking about, man. I think that promo is printing money. I don't know. It, luckily for us, those who have seen it haven't really crossed our path. So I remember it was pretty horrendous and way longer than it should have been. We did multiple TV spots after that that were pretty terrible. And it wasn't until we started doing ridiculous media things where we were literally doing media every day, like radio shows and stuff, that we started having a lot more fun and pretty much lying and making up stuff as we go. Those were a lot better. Unfortunately, those will probably never see the light of day because, you know, they come and go and there's no record of it. But, yeah, that first one was it was pretty brutal.
So, did you get booked out around the country or mostly in and around Mexico City?
Well, we lived in Mexico City and we would pick up our schedules for TV and house shows every Monday. Mm-hmm. And we would work 4 to 6 times a week, typically 5 or 6. And we worked all over the country. Puebla, Pachuca, Cuernavaca, Guadalajara, Acapulco, Monterrey, Laredo, obviously Mexico City, San Juan. I mean, we worked everywhere. It was always different. We would do one of the two TVs every week, and the way they usually did it was they would alternate. If you did Tuesday TV 1 week, then you did Friday at Arena Mexico the next week. And we would do all the CMLL house shows, too, in Coliseo. Outside of that, we would do all the little, I guess you could say, like, third-party sold shows kind of thing. So we were working pretty frequently in pretty much every venue you could.
What were the most, get to work more than one show a day or at any point? Or
I don't recall ever working multiple shows a day. Mostly, I think just because personally, being foreigners, we weren't that good with networking, that's really more for, you're either a local guy or you're somebody like Mystico, who's such a big draw that the opportunity is falling all over you.
Right.
Outside of that, I mean, obviously, we only half know the language, so networking was a bit tough. Otherwise, we probably would have, because our guarantee wasn't very good either.
Mm. Okay, so now, who else did you get to work with in the other towns? Because, obviously, the American Lucha fans would have really just seen your Mexico City matches, but I'm guessing you ended up working with other guys across the country.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of, sometimes we would end up working local guys, and the names of those guys would escape me, but I really love I believe the team name is the Satanicos. Right, with Averno, Mephisto, and Satanico.
Los Infernales.
Yeah, the Infernales. Our debut actually was with the Infernales, and hey, can you guys keep it down real quick?
Yeah.
Just need to record something real quick. Our debut was actually with the Infernales, and we kind of had a non-televised feud with them for most of the time we were there. Anytime that we weren't working with Ricky, Veras, or Volador, it was with them.
So what was it like working with Satanico? Because he was real good for a long time, and appears to be, I'm pretty sure he did discover the Fountain of Youth. Just looking at him, too, not even his wrestling.
Satanico is a perfect example. Hey, Efren, can you grab my necklace from the ring, please?
Where?
It's on the corner. I just don't want to lose it.
What corner?
Just look on the ring post, man. It's a puka shell necklace. Satanico is a good example of a guy like Wayne Gretzky. Somebody that they know the game so well that it doesn't really matter how old they get or how their condition changes physically, for them, the mental game is all it takes, and they just know how to, they know what they're doing, they know how to work,
Now, I guess they're, you or the, now, would you tend to take it easier on the spot shows, or would it be more the older guys, or what?
I try to take it easy every night, to be honest. I Part of the reason, actually, going back to the beginning, why you were asking about my change in schedule, why people haven't seen a lot of me, is because more of my goals now are to be able to get to that point to where mechanically I know the game very well, so that I don't have to always rely on worrying about injury or things like that or where I am. So part of that learning experience is working in different places and aiming higher than you've been before. So I don't know. I guess I'd never really change tempo for different shows like that. That's not really, I don't believe in that, I guess you could say. If you work, you work. If you don't work, you don't work. So I would just say that everybody should be able to take it easy every night, and that should be their highest quality work. So
now, would you go to the CMLL school at Arena Mexico and train with Tanaka there?
He had his school actually over in Coliseo, and we used to we would train with him 3 days a week in Coliseo, and then in between those days we would go over to Arena Mexico and we would use the weight room or train with Ultimo Guerrero, stuff like that. Ultimo Guerrero is another guy that we worked with a lot over there, him and Bucanero, Olympico. There's a lot of guys that we were able to work with, and we trained with... at the time, I want to say he was Astro Boy?
Yeah, Astro Boy.
Allegedly. So, some of you might recognize him now if you're watching CMLL. So we got to work with a lot of good guys.
Okay. So, about how long were you in Mexico?
I would say most of 2003. The beginning of the summer, we bailed, and we were there until the end of winter, so I can't remember the exact dates, and the anniversary show was clear out in September, so we were there for a good chunk of time, and we made return trips, like, sporadically, but the first chunk was maybe the longest run.
Now, I wanted to move back a little bit now. I just was thinking about that, like, you mentioned him, a lot of people who train with Kevin Quinn really seem to hold him in high esteem. Whether it's you, CM Punk, Rita, just everyone. Is there anything specific that made him a great teacher?
Wow, you really know your history, man. I think the thing about Kevin Quinn is that he knows how to make a person better. I mean, he really knows how to read a person. I think that's part of what made him a great wrestler. I think he was really great at what he did. He brings out the best in you. I mean, the things about me that keep me working hard is literally just, I could still hear Kevin in my head. And CM Punk is a really good friend of mine. He says the same thing, and I think that's something that we can all relate. We never forget the sound of Kevin's voice. It's like Mickey in Rocky movies, you know? So, he keeps us working hard. I mean, he never gave us an easy time. For me, he really made me grow. When I was 14, 15 years old, he was having me legitimately have to wrestle and fight with the older guys in the ring just because he knew that I needed to learn not to be a mouse. He knows how to install work ethic, so.
Now, Cobra 2, was it considered a big deal to become the second version of a gimmick that had been, I guess, the guy who was a big star in the 80s?
Well, it wasn't as glamorous as, say, Black Tiger being passed on or something.
Or Tiger
like
Mask.
That. Yeah, which Tiger Mask was one of the ones that, I can't tell you how many times I was told that may be passed on to me, which I think would have been ridiculous because I'm not Japanese. But it was cool for me privately just because I know Cobra 1 and I watched a lot of the Stampede stuff and that generation of Dynamite Kid and how he filled in the juniors when they had the weird stuff going on with the Bulldogs over there. So it was cool for me to be part of that history, whether or not anybody else thought it was a big deal. From a company standpoint, it wasn't like a big glamorous introduction or anything. Mm-hmm. Not like the type of thing where we film promos and stuff up to it, as far as I know. But, it was just really cool on a personal standpoint.
And do you know how they came about deciding, we want to have a Cobra 2 after... And I guess the gimmick hadn't been, I mean, I guess he had been back a little bit, but the gimmick hadn't been around that for a while, for the most part.
Well, I kind of think it was the comparisons to Tiger Mask that were drawn. On my first, at the end of my first and second tour, I want to say, Director Uwai, who was still kind of in charge of New Japan, wanted me to continue to mirror Tiger Mask, the original one, as much as possible. I already naturally moved a lot like him. And because of the MMA training in Los Angeles, a lot of my technique was very similar.
And I remember, like, also hearing you like the British style too, and his whole style was supposed to be like a mishmash of all that.
Yeah, I'm very, very big on catch wrestling. I mean, good catch wrestling. I'm not talking like Johnny Saint catch wrestling, which I think is garbage. Like, I mean, good stuff, like Mark Rocco, and obviously Sayama when he was over there.
Well, you should be glad Quack's not in the room right now.
I'll give it to Quack. But, no, I actually don't mind Johnny Saint that much. I just don't think that he's the bee's knees or anything.
Just because it's sort of, the same routine type of thing, or?
I just don't buy it. In all honesty, I just don't buy it. I think his technique is well thought out, not well executed. You know, that's the difference. But going back to what you were saying, like the comparisons to Tiger Mask and the catch wrestling, the MMA training and all that. I don't think they knew what to do with me, but they wanted me to have more flavor.
There's that exit right there. You just go in and out.
Okay. Where are we?
Okay, I believe it's because they didn't really know what to do with me, and they thought that I could improve on the original Cobra and be more modern, whereas jumping into something like a Tiger Mask is, you know, a very huge deal.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually it's that thought process that brought me to Puma, and they thought it'd be good for me to try to build an original legacy as opposed to trying to bring out an old one. So
that's right, because I remember, now, by the way, you sometimes wear the mask as Puma and sometimes don't, right?
Well, that's a funny piece of business because I was sent to Mexico as Puma. However, they had all of the media from Japan with me without my mask for my first tour, so they said it'd be ridiculous to be working with one.
Mm-hmm.
But they refused to drop the name Puma, so I was part of the Havana Brothers as Puma. when I came back to the States, I worked a couple shows without the mask because I was brought in under the pretenses that they wanted the Puma from Mexico, and I was the Puma from Mexico without a hood.
Like, I remember, yeah, like when you worked the, was that IWA Tag Title Tournament?
Yes,
right?
Yeah, the IWA Tag Tournament. That was a perfect example of what I mean. So that's how that came about, and that's really the only reason why. It's just a couple shows of that nature, you know. They just wanted I guess it just depends on what business leads to what, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess, talking about Tiger Mask, though, what is it that you think has made Tiger Mask 4 by far the longest-lasting one?
Probably because he's really shrewd and won't give up the gimmick.
Does he have the deal personally for the gimmick, for the license?
Well, I do know that on a personal level, he's the most connected with Sayama. He's mm-hmm. He was trained by Sayama. He's good friends with Sayama.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, you know, until he can't physically work anymore, there's really no reason why not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And he definitely has it down to a science, and he does have it defined to him. It's not like he's copying too much. I mean, he redefined what Tiger Mask is for the fourth generation. Kenemoto was an example of a guy who didn't really want that type of situation, which is why, you know, the most interesting thing he ever did was try to be a heel Tiger Mask, you know, and I just think that it was time for him to move on. Misawa, which is unfortunate because he was so talented, came in an odd position, so even if he did anything good, he's following the original. So number four, being so far removed from those two guys, I think had a perfect spot to have a clean palette and do what he needed to do.
Mm-hmm. Why did Misawa wear different colors anyway?
God, I don't know. I really don't know. I also think that number four, since he's heavily...
Sorry, we had got interrupted by a security briefing here at Webster Hall, so I guess that's about it. I want to wish you luck tonight. Should be an interesting night. I haven't been to one of these shows before, obviously. Hoping they come again, because Unfortunately, has not been much of a Lucha Libre presence in New York, oddly enough.
As long as the turnout's as good as we've done in any other city, I'm sure we'll definitely be back.
So. Okay, so that's TJ Perkins, ladies and gentlemen, and I guess just I'll try to be back in a minute, hopefully with more interviews. Hello, everybody. This is David Bixenspan again here on the Loser Leaves Town podcast on CageSideSeats.com. And I am joined right now by probably the top exotico in wrestling right now, Cassandro. How are you doing?
Hi, nice to meet you. It's a pleasure. I'm doing very spectacular. I'm ready for New York. Thank you for your time and for the interview, and I'm excited to be here.
So, is this your first time in New York for anything?
This is my first time for anything in New York, and I'm excited. I am going to be able to, we brought Lucha Vavoom first time, and I'm excited about New York.
Now, New York, for some whatever reason, has not had that much of a Lucha Libre presence in the past, whether it's a more traditional show or a show like this, other than the one time AAA did it in about 15 years ago. So I was wondering, were there any hang-ups as far as getting licenses or promoters' licenses or what, or was it just now was the time to do it?
I think everything falls in place for a reason. The time comes, and this is the time, and we're here, and we're excited. And one of the things that Lucha Vavoom has, that it's not only a wrestling show, it's the burlesque part of it. So this is not seen mostly like Lucha Libre shows, but we have no problem with the commission or anything like that.
Right, okay.
You know, I'm the mother of the chickens.
Okay, so you were trained by Rey Mysterio Sr., right?
That's correct.
Okay.
And Victor Ojeda, my first teacher.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now, I know, Psychosis and Rey Mysterio Jr. and those guys, they were a couple years after you, right? So who was around when you were first breaking in as far as the other trainees and anyone else that would have helped out in the training?
Well, it was Psychosis and Rey Mysterio Jr. and myself. We all trained at the same time.
Oh, so they were already around then. So how old Rey would have been really young, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. He was very young and skinny.
He was like 10 years old then, wasn't he?
Well, no, not that young. But,
Well, no, he's probably, like, what is he now? I don't know. I think he was 19 when, like 15.
Well,
he's like 34 now. So
I just saw him in Tijuana, Mexico. We did a homage for Rey Mysterio Sr.
Mm-hmm.
And we've both been wrestling before. This is our 21st year, and this is my 39th year. I'm 39 years old, and he's something like 34 or something like that, 35 years old.
So
we've been around since we were youngsters, and we're still here, and we still got a lot to give, and that's why we're here, and we get to be like me. I'm the number one exotico in probably the whole world, and the first one ever to become a world champion, and against a legend like El Hijo del Santo in Mexico, and I'm here to prove that, and you know, I give that the open-mindedness of Lucha Vavoom and everything is that we don't care where we come from. We just come to entertain, and it's about the fans.
Now, of the various exoticos when you were a fan growing up and when you were first breaking in, who were your favorites? Because there were so many great wrestlers. There was Pimpinella Escarlata, Adorable Ruby, Rudy Reyna, Vale Greco, all those guys. So, who were your favorites?
Well, one of my favorites all-timers is Baby Sharon. I don't know if you heard of Baby Sharon. And he was the one that schooled me to be elegant, to have a presence, and to not be vulgar in the ring.
Mm-hmm.
As an exotico, the people think that I already am I'm like a clown, and they see me like something very different. But as and Baby Sharon, what taught me is that once I get in the ring, I have to forget about the gay part because I'm gay, you know, and I don't care. But I'm here in the ring to prove that I am a true wrestler, and I get to prove my skills and show the people who I really am, not what they see.
Like, there's comedy to it, but it's not in a distasteful way.
Yeah, right? You know, like, I can do a little bit of comedy, but I'm more of a wrestler, you know. I'm old school, so I get to show the people. Nowadays, like Pimpinella and all those new drag queens are one of the so-called, there's a lot of new people, you know. And they're just copies of myself and Pimpinella, because Pimpinella and me are the pioneers of the new exotico, the makeup, the bathing suits, the glamour, the feathers.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, you see all these youngsters come in, and they're just fake. They're copies of us.
Now, one thing I think I remember reading from one of Lucha Libre reporters is that the previous era of the exoticos, I heard, were straight, and that you and Pimpinella and some of the others are
our day. So I was wondering, what do you think, I mean, was it just you decided to be more open and it was the right time for a gay wrestler to just embrace it?
No, let me tell you, Pimpinella and myself went through the horrors of the homophobics, discrimination, rejection. We, you know, I now that to look back, you know, that was the problem, you know, and I really don't like to go back and feel those horrible feelings, because there were people who stabbed me because I was going to be a wrestler. They pushed me away from companies. They didn't want to give me a wrestler's license. Mm-hmm. And I've been through all that, but you know what? It's worth it. Now, today, 2009, I have opened the doors not only for myself, but for the new people, and I get to be one of the predecessors today, and I thank all the exoticos that were here before. Some were gay, most of them weren't.
Right.
And so that people looked at us different, you know, but it's just the stigma that it's not fair, you know. Like I told a lot of promoters that closed the door in my face, mm-hmm. I don't know what happened to you guys, but I didn't should do anything to you. Mm-hmm. We are not all gay the same, okay? Mm-hmm. I know we're not all the same. I'm here to prove myself that I'm a true professional wrestler. I'm not only an exotic just because of what you see.
Right.
But it was very bad experience, especially coming from Mexico, a machista country, where all this machismo is
coming from. Country, everything.
Yeah, Catholic and everything. And I had it, it started at home. My father still don't accept me to the complete level. You know, I'm sorry for him. You know, I still love him. And there's people that I love, but I love them from a distance because I just got to move out of the way. You know, I don't have to, I don't have to agree whatever they're, I don't know. Yeah. It's been hard, but you know what? This is awesome. We are more now, and we are family in the business. And I am so happy because the fans are the ones that make me. Mm-hmm. I owe everything to the fans. Yeah.
So is it just really great now to be in some place like New York, especially some place like here in the East Village, or in San Francisco or LA, where you really, with Lucha La Baboon, where you really don't have any of that?
Oh yeah, it's great. Look where we're at, Webster Hall.
Yeah.
Madonna was here back in the 84, if I'm not mistaken. And I mean, we've come a long ways. We've come a long ways. And we got to thank like people like you and the press that push us a little bit and take your time for this interview. And look where we're at. And there's a lot more things coming up, you know. There's a lot of things more.
Now, I was wondering why, well, two sort of related questions. Why, but you haven't been around AAA as much lately, and why you didn't end up sticking with the TNA Total Nonstop Action for that long after your debut.
Well, I haven't been going back to Mexico simply because I've been busy. Mm-hmm. I've been to Europe twice. I just got back from being wrestling the first time Lucha Libre was in Paris. Mm-hmm. We wrestled at the Museum of Louvre just last month. And it was 2 days, and it was El Hijo del Santo and Casandro. Mm-hmm. And we went, the government of Mexico sent us. So that's a big, huge thing that I just opened up for Lucha Libre. And also I've been traveling a lot to London and Spain, and I've been doing Japan, and you know, I'm not only here, so most of my time I'm always wrestling. I've always lived off Lucha Libre. Mm-hmm. And in TNA, sadly, but it was very painful, it hurt, but things just didn't work out. Okay. And today I can say no to somebody that doesn't treat me like I deserve. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate everything they did for me, but it didn't work on both parts. It's just one of those things that, okay, we just have to leave it like that.
Now, I remember reading that, you know, I remember in Puerto Rico, Victor Quinones, who was a promoter and was gay, that, you know, he would tell Jim Barnett, you know, he would thank him, oh, you know, it's because of you that I have a place in this business. Do you think that you would be able to do as well if Antonio Peña hadn't been around?
Well, yeah. I have to thank a lot of my predecessors that they're not here with us no more, because they did open the doors for us, and that's why I'm here, and that's why I'm sticking, because I need to open the doors for the ones who are coming up next, you know, because there's a lot more people coming up next. So that's why I need to stay, because you know what? There's a lot many more Cassandros coming in, and I have to be here for them, too. And I have to thank Antonio Peña, fabulous, God bless him, and you rest in peace, you know, and all those other ones.
And just a genius, too. He was
He was a genius to the world of wrestling.
Mm-hmm. And he would get, you know, he'd give everyone a chance, you know, he always read, if he didn't think someone was that charismatic, he'd give them a gimmick, etc., you know.
And he made you a star, even if you were, like, in the starting match, you were the first match, or if you were the main event, he made you a star regardless of rage, age, or whatever, sexual identity, he made you a star. He gave you the chance.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think I was looking at your MySpace earlier. You're currently based out of El Paso?
Born and raised in El Paso. That's where I'm born and raised, and that's where I did my schooling, and yeah, my family lives there, and I have six brothers and sisters. Mom passed away, and I have like 17 nieces and nephews, and I'm just very involved with my family that I love so much.
So did you get to do much wrestling, at least back then, in El Paso and Juarez?
Well, that's where I started.
Yeah, you did.
Okay. No, that's where I started. You know, I was a fan of a wrestling fan since I was like 8 years old, if I can remember. Mm-hmm. And it was in Juarez, and because I was in the border, so I got to go to wrestling school in Juarez and then go to school in El Paso. Mm-hmm. So I had to graduate to become a wrestler. My mom told me, you got to give me a certificate. Mm-hmm. So I graduated from medical school, and then she let me be a wrestler. Mm-hmm. And that's how my life started in Ciudad Juarez, Chihuahua, with my teacher back in 1988.
So you actually went to medical school in Mexico or in the U.S.?
No, in the United States, El Paso. Okay.
Now, did you ever end up practicing?
Yeah, for 6 months. I graduated as a medical administrative assistant, and my specialty is geriatrics with the very sick, and I used to work in nursing homes. Mm-hmm. And I just have a soft heart that I would cry with my patients, and I found that wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. It was too heartbreaking, because I had from little kids to old people, and they were in their terminal stage, and it was too painful for me, and I just decided to go do wrestling.
Okay. So did you, in Juarez, did you get to interact with the Guerreros and stuff when you were breaking in, or were they mostly finished up as far as working there back then?
No, I got to work a lot with Eddie Guerrero, of course, and then I debuted at Chavo Guerrero, Jr.,
yeah.
And then I got to work with Chavo Guerrero, Hector was still around, and Mando, they were just leaving, but I got to work with all of them, and I still be in touch with them. I just saw Hector Guerrero in TNA, and we touched bases, and it was fun, and, you know, I come from there. That's my history, because I grew up being like an idol to them. They were like my. I used to go and cheer for them in Mexico.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the, you know, I have a friend who, you know, grew up there and talks about how great the wrestling was in there, you know, between, you know, with the Guerreros and, you know, like Eddie Guerrero feuding with Negro Casas when they were breaking in and all that.
Just
unfortunately for fans who are younger like me and in a different part of the country, you know, a lot of promoters didn't save videotapes and stuff, but it's definitely, you know, always hear about it, how it was really a hotbed back then, you know, as for young talent.
You know what, and then especially in Ciudad Juarez, we used to have wrestling twice a week, which was Thursdays and Fridays, Thursdays and Sundays, and it was like a religion. It's like, we used to go like in church, family, and then go to wrestling. It was soccer, religion, and lucha libre. That was it before.
And that's like throughout Mexico too, because that's how places like El Torreo was able to have 20,000 people twice a week for years and years. Mm-hmm.
And like in Mexico, I don't know how much you know, but we wrestle Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, every day in Mexico, still to this day.
Yep.
And they start at 9 p.m. and at midnight, and people go to school, but the arenas are still like full of people.
And it's everywhere too, you know, because
they're promoters. In Mexico.
Just, and wherever you can think of too, because someone I know, he went on a trip to Mexico once, same day, he went to like the end of the year show at Arena Mexico, and earlier in the day went to a AAA spot show on a basketball court.
It's like that. One day we're here, one day we're there, you know, like right now we come from Chicago, and right here, now we go to LA, and the journey continues.
Now, I was wondering, why do you think that Tijuana, because, you know, training with Rey Mysterio Sr., I'm sure you wrestle there and stuff, why do you think that, at least compared to the rest of Mexico, it's not as hot as it used to be, as far as fan interest?
Here?
In Tijuana. Compared to the other markets in the country, in Mexico.
Well, let me tell you, it's not only Tijuana, and I'll tell you why. Nowadays, it is very dangerous security, it's becoming to be very dangerous, what's happening in Tijuana and Ciudad Juarez and all those killings and all those things that are going on, that affects us a lot. Plus, also the economy situation don't help, you know. The good thing is that Lucha Libre is not an expensive place to go, you know. If people have to decide sometimes, should I go here or should I eat during the week? So, Lucha Libre is... adjustable and it's still going around, and Tijuana is just going through some bad times, but I'm pretty sure it'll pick up.
On that note, do you think it's pretty interesting how well WWE's done in Mexico given the ticket prices?
Well, yeah, I respect that, you know, but I don't know.
Okay, but because a lot of people talk about, you know, how business will be down in the neighboring towns, you know, after a WWE show. But it's really something because I guess I saw someone compare it once as like they are basically they're charging what essentially in the Mexican economy would be the prices for something like a UFC show here. Right. Okay. So in going around the world.
The show starts in 15 minutes.
Going around the world now and, you know, seeing much more, you know, Mexico and the Southwest and California, what have been your favorite places to travel to now? As far as wrestling.
Well, I love Europe, I love Japan, but I would never change Mexico and the United States. Mm-hmm. Mexico has given me my life, but the United States has given me the power. Mm-hmm. And in Europe, I got to be the number one still right now. And I'm just grateful that I can go to places and show my skills and represent Lucha Libre Mexicana.
Mm-hmm. So... who are your favorite opponents so far in your career and favorite matches and, I guess, most memorable moments that you've had?
Most memorable moments back in November 29th, 1992, when I was crowned the first Exotico ever to win a world title.
That was which one of the, what, which wait, which
UWA.
Way?
UWA.
UWA.
Yeah.
UWA Lightweight.
Yeah.
Okay.
Another one, what was it, June 16th, 2007, the first time I ever lost my hair versus El Hijo del Santo. Mm-hmm. That was very painful. Another one when I got paralyzed for 18 days in Mexico, Querétaro, Mexico.
Oh, I read about that in the Sun interview that you did. Yeah,
I've been paralyzed before. I have many operations. I have many stitches. I've been hurt a lot, and right now my back is killing me. I'm in a lot of pain, but once I get into that ring, people will know that because I give my best.
So I guess that's about it since you have to go and get the show started. So I'd really like to thank you for this great interview. Good luck tonight. I hope you enjoy this here for your big debut in New York. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your time. I love the fans. Thank you. Keep coming back in Rock, Lucha Baboon Rocks.
So, I hope everyone listening enjoyed those interviews today. For the archive of past shows, please check out loserleavestown.net or davidbix.com. And for all the new shows and also the rundown with pictures and everything and match descriptions or what have you of the Lucha Vavoom show, check out cagesideseats.com. We're gonna fly. We're gonna see. Thank you.